This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Zähneputzen am Morgen ist selbstverständlich. Warum nicht auch Sonnenschutz? 90% der Hautalterung entstehen durch Sonnenlicht. Das Beste, was du also für deine Haut tun kannst, täglicher UV-Schutz, auch an Tagen mit niedrigem UV-Index. Entdecke jetzt den Testsieger laut Stiftung Warentest. Die Eucerin Oil Control Gel Creme mit Lichtschutzfaktor 50+ macht täglichen Sonnenschutz ganz einfach. Sie ist ultraleicht, zieht schnell ein und mattiert langanhaltend. Mit dem Code SUN20 bekommst du jetzt 20% Rabatt auf alle Eucerin Sun Produkte bei shopapotheke.com. Nur bis zum 31. Juli.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Hello, you're about to hear Series 3 of Lady Killers. New episodes will be released weekly. But if you're in the UK and you can't wait, you can hear the whole series now, first on BBC Sounds. Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. Join me and a team of all-female detectives as we travel back in time to revisit the unthinkable crimes of some of the most notorious murderesses of the 19th and 20th centuries in Britain, Australia, and the USA. This episode contains material that you might find distressing. Now, we worry a lot, don't we, about the lack of privacy today, about the invasiveness of social media. But imagine living in mid-19th century Ireland, where you have pretty much no privacy at all. Your neighbours are in and out of your house all day, peering over your garden wall. You live in constant fear of being judged and shamed. And in this society, what could be more shameful than your daughter expecting an illegitimate child? As the neighbours talk and the rumours spread, you'd probably deny it, wouldn't you?
I was in Jim Boyd's house that day, last Saturday, but it was 1 o'clock. Jim was in the garden digging at the elm tree. I said it's a strange time to be digging in a garden.
There's no child here. There was no child.
Not only are your neighbours questioned about the fate of this child, your young son is too. If he says the wrong thing, both you and your daughter might face a death sentence. I'm Lucy Worsley, and we're examining the lives of murderesses of the past, sometimes ordinary women who did extraordinary things. We hear their words, their voices, and we visit the scene of their crimes. We're seeking to understand these women, to understand their crimes from the perspective of 21st century feminists. This time, we're exploring the case of Jane Boyd, a woman who wasn't well off, from the parish of Holywood, just outside Belfast. In October 1861, Jane's unmarried teenage daughter, Anne, was sent home in disgrace from her job as a domestic servant because she was pregnant. And with that, the life of the whole family was turned upside down. Curious to find out more about Jane and Anne Boyd, I went to Holywood with our resident historian, Rosalind Crone, Professor of History at the Open University.
So this is downtown Holywood, and I can see some quite large, prosperous, Victorian-looking houses over there.
Yeah, that's right. So the town of Holywood was really transformed in about 1848 with the arrival of the railway. Wealthy middle classes in Belfast moved out to Holywood and built new homes and came to have a nice life by the sea, away from the dirt and grime of the city.
It's certainly bracing here. I can feel the sea wind.
Now, not everyone benefited from this great prosperity. There was still a rural community as part of this parish that lived slightly inland from here and some significant poverty as well. And that's where our family, the Boyds, were located.
The Boyds house, is it still there?
Okay, so unfortunately the 19th century census for Ireland doesn't survive. Okay, so what we do is we rely on a survey of households and land that was carried out by a man called Richard Griffiths. Now in 1861 he came to Holywood and mapped it out, and you can see all the householders listed here, and if you run down the page, William Boyd. Now, yep, there he is. The great thing about Griffith's valuation is, as well as listing everyone, He also made maps. I've brought a copy of his maps with me.
It says, what's that? Description of property. And William Boyd is living in a house and a small garden, is that right?
And if you see the value, it is extremely low. £1.05. So it's likely that he was an agricultural labourer leasing out a very small property. And there's no acreage here with that house. So there's nothing to farm.
Do you think we can go and find the Boyd family house?
It was walkable. People would walk in those days. But I think today we might drive. I didn't bring my wellies.
Whew. Well, this is bracing. There's the sea, look.
There's the sea, yeah. And you can see this woodland on this side. Now, we think the Boyds lived on the other side of that.
It's quite remote up here, isn't it? And I guess a lot of people will have emigrated from this part of the world in the wake of the famine.
Our case is a decade post-famine, 1861. But there's still a lot of churn in the population. We're standing here, lots of open space, houses quite separated, and it feels quite private. But back then, you've got to remember, this was very much a community where people had their eyes on each other. It was a very religious society at this time, predominantly Protestant and Presbyterian. People were helping each other out, people were supporting each other, but also it's about ensuring that social norms are upheld, the community is held together, and people do the right thing.
To help me understand the legal background to this case, I'm very fortunate to be joined today by the Lady Chief Justice of Northern Ireland, the Right Honourable Dame Siobhan Keegan. Before becoming Lady Chief Justice, she was a barrister specialising in family law and then one of Northern Ireland's first female High Court judges. Welcome, Dame Siobhan.
Thank you very much, Lucy. Thank you for inviting me.
You became Lady Chief Justice in 2021, the first woman to be head of the judiciary in Northern Ireland. At the time of our case, the 1860s, the legal system was all male. That's judges, lawyers, male juries too. Do you think that women are fairly represented now in the criminal justice system?
Well, the representation across the profession is 50% or more women in roles, certainly as young practitioners. The problem is when you get to people becoming King's Counsel, partners in solicitors' offices, traditionally there's a difficulty because of the responsibilities of family life. Now, I think that's a matter of time. And the fact that I'm Chief Justice here, I think helps. And we've lots of very good, engaged young women who I think can achieve great things.
Let's get back to our case. Now, just down the road from Holywood is the Ulster Folk Museum. It's a fabulous place. You can go into all these houses and shops and public buildings that have been brought together there from all over Northern Ireland. And when we went there, I was particularly taken by a little thatched cottage, whitewashed with thick walls, tiny windows. It was tucked away down a lane. It was very much like the one that the Boyds occupied in the early 1860s.
It looked lovely from the outside. On a sunny day, inside it's pretty damp. To be honest, it chills the bones. And this is not a big house for a family of five. We have William Boyd, the dad. He's described as being of excellent character. Then there's Jane, the mum. There's a grown-up daughter called Mary Jane. There's a son, James. Little James, he's only 10. And then there's Anne. Anne is 19 years old. She's recently come home from a job, domestic service, in Dundonald, a few miles away. And Anne is pregnant. What happens on the morning of Sunday, the 27th of October, 1861? A man called Constable Waters receives some information that brings him to the Boyd's cottage. He's come from the Holywood barracks. Who's at home? Well, Jane Boyd is, and her two daughters, but there's trouble. Anne, the teenage daughter, is desperately ill. She's unconscious. She's being treated by the local doctor, Dr. Dunlop. And Dr. Dunlop tells Constable Waters that he believes that Anne has just given birth. But Jane Boy says, no, that's not the case at all. Anne has had a miscarriage. Dr. Dunlop and Constable Waters are unconvinced. Something's a bit funny. They go out together into the garden. Out in the garden, there's an elm tree. And under the elm tree is a patch of new dug ground. And in this ground are planted 7 big cabbages. This is suspicious. The doctor and the constable are drawn to the disturbed ground and they start to dig. They go down 2.5 feet. Oh, and there they discover the body of a little baby girl, sort of hidden away underneath a slate, a stone and some dried grass. Dr. Dunlop takes out the little corpse and goes back into the house and he does a post-mortem. Now, Jane Boyd is going to have to change her story. This was not a miscarriage.
There was a child. It was buried in the garden. The child was dead. It was born dead. Sure, it was born dead.
Later that week, an inquest is held with a jury of 12 local men and a coroner whose job it is to establish the cause of death. It's very likely that the body of the baby would have been on display in the courtroom. Anne, the mother, is still ill, so it's Jane, the grandmother, who's the focus of the court. I find the record of this inquest fascinating because it reveals just how many people were in and out of the boys' cottage and generally nosing about the neighbourhood on that Saturday morning and gave birth. There's Mary McCulloch, a peddler of no settled residence.
I came to Jane Boyd's house on Saturday evening between 5 and 6 o'clock. She said Anne was ill, suffering from a pain of the stomach. She told me to go and see the sick girl, who then fell into a fit. She told me nothing of a child.
And then there's Mary Ann Boyd, a relative who lives nearby. She's also called to give evidence.
At 6 o'clock, I went up to the house and Jane said she was going for a doctor. I saw Anne in convulsions. Dr. Dunlop said there had been a confinement, but Jane said, "Nay, confinement here."
What do you think, Dame Siobhan, about all of these neighbours giving evidence? How reliable are they? Nosy neighbours.
Yeah.
That sort of person gets a bad reputation.
It's intriguing that you ask me this because as a judge, we obviously sit and listen to people and we judge what people are saying, how credible they are. Do they have a motivation to lie? Do they have an axe to grind? I can't see at the moment that there's anything that stands out as unreliable as such from the witnesses. I mean, this must have been quite a difficult situation for them. The family, from what I can work out, were well thought of. The neighbours probably, I suppose, wouldn't intuitively want to get involved with this. This is an emotive subject matter because there's a child involved at the heart of it.
Today, I guess we're less likely to be physically in and out of each other's houses like Jane Boyd's neighbours were, but we are likely to know an awful lot about what's going on in our friends' and neighbours' lives from social media. Social media posts are often brought as evidence, aren't they, Dame Siobhan, in court now. How has the system had to adapt to these newer kinds of evidence?
Well, we've had to keep pace. In lots of cases, courts are being asked to view Twitter exchanges, Facebook exchanges, WhatsApp exchanges. Now, I think that the problem with it is that there isn't often a filter or a cooling off period, and it's a record as to what people say, sometimes in the heat of the moment. The challenge for an adjudicator or a judge is to assess it within context. Are they an informed observer or not? Have they, as I had said earlier, an axe to grind, an agenda?
Now, at the inquest for Anne Boyd's baby, the most damning evidence so far comes from the neighbour, Mary Hill.
I was in Jane Boyd's house that day, last Saturday, but it was 1 o'clock. Jane was in the garden digging at the elm tree. I said it's a strange time to be digging in a garden. She said she was digging to plant winter cabbage. I asked her how her daughter was because I'd heard she had cramps and stitches. I went in to see Anne and she said she would send for a doctor and she said it wasn't easy to pay 5 shillings for a doctor.
So it sounds like this Mary Hill arrived at the Boyd's house while Anne was still in labour. So does this make it possible, Dame Siobhan, that Jane was digging a grave for her grandchild before it was even born?
Well, if that's the case, we're into a premeditated area.
Exactly.
That is fairly damning evidence, as opposed to a spontaneous act that is brought about as a result of panic, shame, all of the rest. So if Mary Hill's to be believed, there is a massive issue here because there is a plan in place, and I'm afraid that would lead to the criminal law coming down fairly heavily.
Now, to prove murder in the case of the Boyds, the coroner has to establish that this baby was born alive. So the evidence of the next person at the inquest is crucial. This is Jane's 10-year-old son, James. This is Anne's little brother. He solemnly swears to tell the truth, and then he drops a bombshell.
Last Saturday morning, after digging potatoes, my mother sent me for a spade to Mr. McDoyle's. I got it and put it at the side of the house. I went into the house to get my dinner. I sat in the kitchen and heard my sister Anne screaming. I went to the door of the room, but it was shut. My mother was in the room with Anne. I heard my sister screaming for a good while. Then, after my sister screamed, I heard like the sound of a child. It was crying. It did not cry for very long. It gave 3 cries.
Oh, poor James Boyd can have had no idea that his evidence that Anne's baby was born alive, it cried, could send both his sister and his mother to the gallows. And the evidence of Dr. Dunlop is even more damning. He describes the injuries to the baby's body that he discovered during his post-mortem. And do be warned, this is very upsetting.
I took the body of the baby out of the hole in the garden. It was full grown and had been born alive, and there's no doubt it breathed for some time. The right side of the head was smashed in and the lower jaw broken close to the ear. There was a fracture to the skull. Its death may have arisen from 2 causes, either from suffocation or from violent injuries.
So it seems likely that Anne's baby was killed with the spade that little James had been sent to borrow from the neighbour. After all this evidence, what is the outcome of the inquest? Well, the coroner finds a verdict of willful murder against Jane Boyd, and she's immediately removed to Downpatrick Jail, 25 miles away, to await trial. Back at the Ulster Folk Museum, I asked Ros Crone about the frequency of this sort of crime in the 19th century. Ros, this is a completely shocking thing, isn't it? But having said that, is it the case that infanticide wasn't that uncommon in the 19th century?
That's right, Lucy. The historian Elaine Farrell has estimated that in Ireland in the second half of the 19th century, infanticide was a weekly event. And that was using the official criminal statistics. And those women who registered their marital status in the criminal record, more than 60% of them were unmarried. So it does suggest that infanticide was largely a way of dealing with illegitimacy. And if you can think of the shame, the stigmatisation of illegitimacy and the fear of the woman of being expelled from her community, from her church, you know, even her family, that would be definitely a driving factor. And in our case, we have Anne Boyd, domestic servant, who's come back pregnant. Domestic servants were at particular risk. They've been sent away from home and they were vulnerable to the attentions of all the men around them, from the people who lived in the house with them to workers as well. And if you were found out as a domestic servant that you were pregnant, you were sent home, and you were sent home without a reference. So economic shame, social conditions.
Dame Siobhan, I was pretty shocked by what Roz was saying there about the number of babies being killed at that time. What's your reaction? Did you find it as surprising as I did?
I did. But it's actually interesting to think about the level of reporting as well, because for every case, for every Boyd case, I imagine there were other cases that went undetected for whatever reason. They were perhaps events happening in more isolated communities where there weren't witnesses.
Yeah, and we have the indulgence, if you like, of being able to be shocked and ashamed and outraged by the decisions of people who have fewer options than we do. The options for people like Anne Boyd, who were facing an unwanted pregnancy, were very limited. They were backstreet abortion, adoption, or infanticide. There wasn't access to effective contraception or legal abortion.
Yeah, but I think it correlates with how children were viewed and valued in society, linked to poverty and social conditions and social hierarchy.
Well, back at the Ulster Folk Museum, Roz Crane and I visited the reconstructed courthouse, a building a bit like the one where Jane and Anne were brought on the 10th of March, 1862, at Downpatrick. They went on trial there before Judge Hayes and 12 male jurors. Roz and I climbed the stairs to a large, austere, wood-panelled and really rather intimidating space.
Now, Roz, Jane and Anne Boyd were tried. The trial was over quite quickly, wasn't it? Because they both pleaded guilty. They pleaded guilty to a crime of concealment of birth. It's not a charge that exists today, is it?
No. In the early 19th century, there's no such crime as infanticide as such. Women who are suspected of killing their babies are charged with murder. However, for a murder trial to be successful, you need to prove intention. And maybe that's evidence that a pregnancy was concealed. And you also need to prove that a baby was born alive and so was killed by the mother. That wasn't very easy to prove. And so juries had an alternative from 1803. They could bring back a verdict of concealment of birth instead. Now, in 1861, the law changed to allow a separate independent charge of concealment of birth, not just as an alternative verdict to murder in a trial. And also, those who were not the mother could be charged with this offence too. In this case, the grandmother, Jane.
So let's hear Judge Hayes's verdict.
You have pleaded guilty to a charge of concealing the birth of the infant child of Anne Boyd. Only you two prisoners and the powers above know whether or not that child was fairly dealt with. But I do have very strong suspicions about the matter. And it is to the tender mercies of the Crown that you are not both standing at the bar charged with the willful murder of that child.
Now, this is interesting. When it came to the sentencing, the judge made a distinction between the two women. Both of them were to get imprisonment with hard labour, but Anne Boyd was to get 6 months, and Jane Boyd, that's the grandmother of the baby, was to get 2 years. And that's because Jane was considered to be an active participant in the dreadful deed, whereas Anne, who was sick, was just an onlooker. Seems to me, Roz, that the injuries to the baby were so severe, so obvious, that Jane was pretty lucky to get away with this concealment of birth as opposed to murder. What do you think about that?
Juries prove very reluctant to convict, especially when the sentence for murder was hanging. These were not dangerous women. They weren't going to go out and kill other people. It was also about the value that was placed on the life of an infant, which might seem shocking to us today. So you could see it as getting away with it, but actually you could flip it around and see it from another point of view. If juries are so reluctant to convict for murder, providing an alternative verdict or an alternative charge like concealment is making sure they don't get away with it.
Chief Justice Dame Siobhan, can you give me any insight to what it feels like, perhaps to be Judge Haynes and to be pretty sure that this woman had killed a baby, and yet he's not convicting her of murder, the system's not convicting her? of murder.
I think he really was faced with accepting that plea and sentencing as best he could. Putting myself in his position, you couldn't help but have a level of compassion, especially for the young woman who was pregnant in this case. The flip side of that is you would be outraged at the death of a baby, which was violent. I don't underestimate the challenge there.
Are you saying it's not easy being a judge?
Yes, I am. I think people looking in at how judges work see the end result.
Yes.
But they don't see how a judge will agonise over the human stories that come before him or her every day, and how we as judiciary try to get the right balance in the cases that come before us, which can be fairly challenging, and in this case I think was.
Our historian Ros Crone is also in the studio with me. Ros, what would you take away from the story, from the case?
I think it's important to remember that infanticide has been a fact of life through history. The 19th century, historians have said, showed an increase in infanticide. And what we're dealing with here is one of the ways that unwanted pregnancy was handled. Mm. And I think we have to be very careful today when thinking about the way we deal with women and reproduction and their bodies. If you create conditions in which women cannot deal with that unwanted pregnancy, aside from having the baby and somehow coping financially, then it gives rise to other unsavory alternatives, from illegal abortion through to infanticide.
Let me tell you the end of the story. Both Jane and Anne Boyd survived their sentences of hard labour. After that, though, like the majority of poorer women, they just disappear from the historical record. You know, I've been shocked to learn just how many women were killing their newborn babies in 19th century Ireland. And I'm also moved, actually, by the insight we've gained into the mind, the humanity, if you like, that exists within our judges, then and now. I'm personally inclined to believe that Jane Boyd did kill that baby. But like the judge in her case, I'm also inclined to feel a bit of mercy towards her, because it's pretty awful to imagine a world in which social and financial pressures would drive a grandmother to murder her newborn grandchild. Well, a huge thank you to Dame Siobhan Keegan, to Professor Rosalind Crone, and to everybody at the Ulster Folk Museum. Next time on Lady Killers, I'm in Kent, where the relationship between a stepmother and a stepdaughter goes horribly wrong. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Grace, Catherine and Margaret Cunningham, Patrick Kelly Bradley, William McBride and Jonathan Keeble. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. What can the Lady Killers cases teach us about the authenticity of women's stories? The Open University takes a look at how we can reclaim women's voices from history. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University. Thanks for listening. If you're enjoying Lady Killers, we have a brand new episode every week. But if you're in the UK and you can't wait, you can hear all the episodes now, first on BBC Sounds.
I love you.
I know that.
Carolyn is 80, a wealthy widow. Dave is in his 50s, homeless, a former drug addict with a long criminal record. Their love affair causes a huge rift in Carolyn's family.
That's our mom. We're not going to let you just do that.
I'm Sue Mitchell, and this story unfolded in California on the street where I live.
Look at you brought into your house.
He's a con artist, mother.
Is Dave a dangerous interloper or the tender carer he claims to be?
That's why I'm here.
Thank the Lord.
Find out in Intrigue, Million Dollar Lover from BBC Radio 4. Listen on BBC Sounds.
If anything happens to you,
I will just die.